my own dog food. And I used the software to present this. And also, the other apology is that the paper is not has not appeared. It should have appeared a long time ago. But we keep reinventing the framework and making it better and more compelling. Even though the results don't change, the framework keeps changing. And so that kind of tends to delay the process of having the thing appear. So let me just start with a little motivation, probably not necessary for anybody here, but we'll do it anyways. Orientifolds are sort of procedure for obtaining new string backgrounds from old ones, sort of like orbifolds are. And they've proven extremely useful for model building, particularly when you turn on fluxes, a la KKLT and many, many successors. And the main reason why they proved to be so ubiquitous in that literature is because they evade a certain no-go theorem due to Gibbons and Maldacena and Nunez, which basically say that you can't get a background with positive four-dimensional cosmological constant if either in pure supergravity or even if you add sources like D-brains, which obey the strong energy condition. There's a sort of no-go theorem that says you can't get a background with positive four-dimensional cosmological constant. And there are two ways to get around this. One is to look at backgrounds where the alpha prime corrections are important. And once you have the four derivative terms, this theorem goes out the window. Or you can introduce sources which violate the strong energy condition, like orientifold planes, which have negative tension. The advantage of doing the latter is that you still can use sort of supergravity reasoning, which means that the moduli stabilization problem is sort of within calculational control for such backgrounds. So that's why those why orientifolds are so prominent in the current literature. But that's not the aspect I'm going to focus on today. What I'm going to focus on is the background D-brain charge carried by orientifolds. And on a compact space, you know, if you have some six-dimensional compact manifold or whatever, that charge needs to be canceled for consistency. This is some generalization of Gauss's law. So a question, natural question that arises is it possible to cancel the background charge rationally but not cancel it over the integers? That's to say, could you possibly leave over some uncancelled charge, which is torsion, which is Zn value? Okay. The answer is yeah, sure, it seems possible. But in order to really make a definitive statement, you actually have to know what the background charge is, not rationally, but over the integers, and only then could you say whether or not it's cancelled. And it's only ever been computed rationally, and if you look at all of the literature, in other words, ignoring the possibility of some Zn-valued stuff left over. And so what Dan Fried and Greg Moore and I set out to do was actually rectify this and give a formula over the integers. And I really want to emphasize that this is a topological question. We're trying to satisfy Gauss's law. We're not trying to satisfy the equations of motion or the equations which guarantee unbroken supersymmetry or anything like that. This is a purely, in the end, a purely topological question about the consistency of the background, not whether or not it satisfies some equation of motion or something. And as a sort of subsidiary objective, and this is sort of the cause of the interminable delay in producing this paper, what we end up doing is cleaning up a little bit of the literature on orientifolds, which is kind of a little gnarly when you get into it. So what's the bottom line? The bottom line is we're going to have some picture of the background orientifold charge taking values in some particular variant on K-theory, which I'll describe. And the first thing that you should learn, I guess the first takeaway, is that over the integers, it is not localized on the orientifold planes. However, if you invert 2, that's to say you kill all torsion, which is Z2, Z4, Z8, and so on, valued, then, and as far as I know, only then, does the background charge localized to the orientifold fixed planes. If you take turn characters, in other words, you throw away all of the torsion information and you just look rationally, what you get back is the sort of usual formulas that you find in the literature, where essentially the Ramond-Ramond field provides a trivialization of the sum of two terms. One is the contribution due to the D-brains. The other one is the contribution due to the orientifolds. And sometimes it's frequently found in the literature that this H-wedge G term is put on the right-hand side of the equation. It's viewed as a source. But I will contend that that's morally wrong, and you should actually put it on the left-hand side of the equation, not on the right. So let me give a very rapid review of orbifolds just to warm up. Everybody just came from lunch, so we're all a little, you know, doing a little slow. You start, imagine, I'm going to give a worldsheet description. So you have a sigma model from some worldsheet into some target space. And imagine there's some discrete group of isometries of the target space. And what we'd like to do is gauge that symmetry. And so the way you do it is you consider, you call that group capital gamma. You consider gamma principal bundles over sigma. So if I forget about the group structure, this is a set of just order of gamma points over each point in sigma. Right? So it's some Riemann surface, which is a cover of sigma. And you consider equivariant maps from this covering space into your target space Y. So you have this nice little commutative diagram where here's the action of the group on this principal bundle, and here's the action of the group on Y, and an equivariant map is a map which makes that little diagram commute. This thing is, by definition, fixed point free. The action on sigma tilde is fixed point free. So our original surface is just the quotient, sigma tilde mod gamma, since it acts freely. And if you want to use a slightly fancy language, this defines a map from sigma into the stack Y mod gamma. If you want to describe the states of the orbifold conformal field theory, well, all you have to do is allow gamma to have in and out boundaries. You know, the quantizing the thing on a circle gives you the Hilbert space. And restricting to a boundary circle, what you get are gamma principal bundles over the boundary circle. And these are classified by the holonomies. And the upshot is that the twisted sectors, which are the non-trivial gamma bundles, over this boundary circle are just conjugate C classes of gamma, which is the usual result that you're all familiar with. Same story for orientifolds. I'm going to consider a sort of somewhat more general, well, it's frequently used in the literature, so it pays us to consider this. Imagine now that gamma has a homomorphism to Z2 and call the subgroup which is killed by that gamma naught. Okay? Then as a set, you can split the elements of gamma up into the guys that are in gamma naught and everybody else. And I want to emphasize that even if gamma naught is abelian, gamma can and almost invariably is non-abelian in examples. Okay. And what we'd like to do is gauge gamma, but this time accompany those guys which are not in gamma naught by orientation reversal on the world sheet. And so again, what you have is some picture like this, where gamma tilde is a gamma principal bundle over your original, sigma tilde is a gamma principal bundle over your original surface sigma. And the action here is fixed point free and orientation preserving for the subgroup gamma naught and orientation reversing for elements in gamma 1. And again, if you restrict to in and out circles to get what the Hilbert space looks like, what you see is actually, well, since there's no fixed point free orientation reversing map of the circle, the orientation double cover of sigma is just sigma tilde mod gamma naught, and the orientation double cover of one of your in-out circles is actually a pair of circles which get exchanged, because there's no thing that would take a circle into itself in an orientation reversing fixed point free fashion. Okay? So restricting to one copy of the circle, that gives you a reduction of the structure group, and now I see that the upshot was cut off, which is really bad. Ouch, the last line of my transparency is cut off. The upshot, and this is going to have ramifications for future slides. I can write on the blackboard. The upshot of this is that what you do is that the twisted sectors of this theory are conjugacy classes of elements of gamma naught inside of gamma. That's the result. Okay, and it's a little bit disappointing not to have the punchline. It's going to be more disappointing later. So that's my review of the world sheet theory of orientifolds. You can read more about it in Polchinski's book. I'm now going to talk about some of the other ingredients in some discussion of, you know, what we're on about. So a thing you might talk about, the Ramond-Ramond fields in string theory as an exotic sort of abelian gauge theory. So let's again review the abelian gauge theory we all grew up with, which is electromagnetism. And you think of the electric current as sort of a D minus one form, which is, if you put some compact support conditions, it's cohomologically non-trivial. And magnetic current is a three form, again, which could be non-trivial if you have put some compact support conditions. And the electromagnetic field trivializes these two currents. Okay, the reason why you can do this is because we don't put a compact support condition on the electromagnetic field. We allow it to, you know, have a non-zero integral off at infinity. That's again what we call Gauss's law. And so we allow these things are trivial in the compactly supported cohomology, but non-trivial in the compactly supported cohomology, but trivial in the full thing. And the electromagnetic field is the thing that trivializes it. In the quantum theory, classically these were arbitrary. In the quantum theory, you need some sort of Dirac quantization condition. And what the Ramond-Ramond fields do is they replace this Dirac cohomology story with some more general one and some generalized cohomology theory, some kind of K theory or other. And the Dirac quantization condition becomes sort of integrality of some bilinear form on that generalized cohomology theory. So the other ingredient that makes the Ramond-Ramond field story special is that it's a self-dual theory, which is to say that the electric and magnetic currents are not independent, but in fact, if you give me one, I know what the other one is and vice versa. Okay, so there's actually a map which takes this exotic cohomology theory at degree I to the one at degree D plus 2 minus I, and it relates the electric and magnetic currents. Okay, D here is 10, but I wrote it in arbitrary dimensions. And when you wanted to find the quantum theory for a self-dual theory, you need not this bilinear form, which was the good old Dirac quantization condition that you learned about on your grandfather's knee. What you need is this refined thing, which is called a quadratic refinement of this bilinear form. Because remember, the two currents aren't independent, right? And this quadratic refinement, think about a quadratic function, you know, ax squared plus bx plus c, okay? And let's choose c to be 0, so the q of 0 is 0. Okay, well, you see, if you take q of x1 plus x2 and then subtract off q of x1 and q of x2, you kill the quadratic pieces and you just have something that's bilinear in x1 and x2. That's our original bilinear form. Okay, and to define the quantum theory, what you actually need is not that, but this q. Okay? And now every quadratic function, you've all drawn parabolas, every quadratic function has a center, right, about which it's symmetric. Okay? And now let me tell you, so a way to get at the center is to just define a linear function, which is q of x minus q of minus x. Okay, and you can, since this, I didn't say, but since this bilinear form is a perfect pairing, you can always write that linear function as the pairing with some class lambda. And then Q of lambda also vanishes. So Q of 0 was 0, Q of lambda is also 0. And then the center of Q, the thing about which it's symmetric, is some class mu such that 2 mu equals lambda. And this determines mu, the center, up to 2 torsion, because 2 times something that's 2 torsion is 0. And for the purpose, you can actually do better, but for the purposes of this lecture, since I'm going to invert 2 anyways at some point, I might as well just stop there and say this determines mu. So the simplest example of this is type 1 theory, which is an orientifold of type 2b with a trivial action of z2 on the target space. And the charge group there is just the real K theory, the KO theory of your target space. And Dan Fried and Mike Hopkins computed this quadratic function Q and found its center and found actually the familiar result. Probably you're used to 32 over here, but in the case of a curved target space, it's actually the tangent bundle plus a 22, rank 22 trivial bundle. Up to codimension 8, things involving the second Pontryagin class and whatnot. But don't worry, this is actually, if you if you're familiar with the heterotic string version of this, you know, type 1 is dual to the spin 32 mod z2 heterotic string, you're familiar with this answer, right? That the gauge bundle and the tangent bundle, their second Chern classes agree, some story like that. That's this condition. Okay. So our objective is just to generalize this to other orientifolds in a nutshell. Differential cohomology. I'm actually really interested in the currents, not just their sort of cohomology classes. And so there's a formalism for discussing such things called the differential cohomology, where you add geometrical data to the topological, the purely topological information. And I will not define it, but rather I'll proceed by example. So at H naught, you just get the usual cohomology. H1 is isomorphic to the maps from X into the circle, or in other words, circle-valued scalars whose corresponding one form is just a Durham representative of a class in H1 of the manifold. Okay, so you have some cohomological information, but more than that, you have actually an actual dynamical field, in this case, a circle-valued scalar. H2 is the isomorphism classes of complex line bundles with connection. Okay, so the topological information is the first Chern class of the complex line bundle. That's the topological class. But you also have an actual genuine connection whose curvature is the Durham representative of that cohomology class. H-check 3 is the place where the B field lives in string theory, and so on. Okay. And these things fit into some exact sequences. So let me take the example of Q equals 2, which was, remember, was complex line bundles with connection. Okay, so over here is the first Chern class. And over here, you have a closed 2 form with integer periods. That's the field strength. Over here, what you have are flat connections. Okay, so the what's missing from the field strength are the flat connections on the manifold. Over here, what you have are actual one forms, modulo closed one forms with integer periods. That's the group of gauge transformations. The small gauge transformations are the exact one forms. The quote-unquote large gauge transformations are the not exact ones, which have integer periods. So this is essentially gauge connections modulo gauge transformations. And well, I've explained all the other boxes. So if you want, that's telling you what this differential H2 is. And in our case, we're going to be interested in differential K theory. And the currents, the D-brain current and the Orentifold current, are going to live over here, and the Ramon-Ramon field strengths are going to live over here. Basically, the picture. And it'll be helpful to have a sort of, some sort of specific model in mind. Usually, when people tell you about K-theory, they say, "Oh, it's finite. It's sort of formal differences of vector bundles." Okay. What I'd like to think of instead is Z2 graded vector bundles, where E naught is the even part and E1 is the odd part, and an odd skew adjoint endomorphism from E to itself. And in many applications, E has to be infinite dimensional and T has to be a Fredholm operator. But for the most part, you can just think of finite dimensional Z2 graded vector bundles with an odd skew adjoint endomorphism. That's the definition of K. The equivalence classes of such things is K0. If you want to talk about higher K theory, what you do is you introduce a Clifford algebra, an n-dimensional Clifford algebra. And then the higher K groups are represented as pairs carrying an action of the Clifford algebra, which commutes with T, and where the gammas are considered odd in Z2 grading. Okay? And the equivalence classes of such things are your higher K groups. And then there are all kinds of variants on this story where you just add more structure to the game. So KR theory, which is one of the things we'll talk about. Imagine you have an involution map from X to itself, which lifts to an antilinear action on the fibers of your vector bundle, E, and which commutes with T and with the Clifford action. And then the equivalence classes of such objects are the KR groups of your manifold. If sigma acts trivially, then this is just an antilinear involution of the fibers of E, which is to say it's a real structure, which is to say that's KO theory, the theory of real vector bundles, K theory of real vector bundles. Another similar variant is called equivariant K theory, where you have some group that acts on X and lifts to an even linear action on E, which commutes with T and with the Clifford algebra, with the Clifford action. And then if you take the equivalence classes of those things, those are your equivariant K theory groups. And then there's some hybrid, which is along the lines that we were interested in, where you have a group gamma with a homomorphism to Z2, and depending on whether your element of gamma is annihilated by this homomorphism or not, then the action lifts to something even linear or even antilinear on the fibers. And the cohomology and the equivalence classes of such things don't have actually a name, and this is part of the story is to actually define this. They're related to the KR groups of a certain stack, which is the double cover of the stack Y mod gamma. So I've said the word stack 3-4 times now, and this is really unfortunate. I have to say, I fought bitterly against this, so I'm on your side. I really didn't want to use this language, but it turns out to be really amazingly powerful and concise. So I'm going to tell you everything you ever wanted to know about stacks in 5 minutes, 10 maybe. Okay. So these have appeared in the physics literature before, mostly in the work of Pantev and Sharp on orbifolds. Now, you might say that's not the physics literature, but right. well, I have to say I was kind of skeptical of you know, the motivation behind what they did, and hence my reluctance to get into this subject in my own work. But it really proves, well, useful. So let me start with the concept of a groupoid. Kind of a generalization of a group. So category theory is this thing where you have circles and arrows. Okay, you got objects, which are dots, and arrows connecting them, okay, which are called morphisms. Okay, and you're allowed to, you know, to compose morphisms if you have something that begins on one dot and ends on another, and then something that starts on that dot and goes to another one, you can compose those two. And so a groupoid is one where all of the morphisms are invertible. Okay? And a group is a special kind of groupoid where there's just one object. So all of the arrows begin and end on the same dot. Okay? And they're all invertible. That's a group. Okay? A groupoid is something where you've got a bunch of dots, but all of the arrows are invertible. There's always an arrow going in the opposite direction such that the composition is the identity. Okay? That's it. That's a groupoid. And a stack is basically a particular type of groupoid, which I will now describe on the rest of this transparency. And so let's take all of the objects together and call them X0, and all of the morphisms and call them X1. And then I have two maps I'll call P0 and P1, where for every morphism, P0 tells you the source, and P1 tells you the target. Okay? There's the picture there. Okay, very simple. The first condition is that X0 and X1 are smooth manifolds. These, and then there's some technical conditions. These are local diffeomorphisms, and P0 cross P1 is a proper map. Don't worry about that too much. And to get a Deline-Mumford stack, all you need is that the stabilizers of every point in X0. So X is a element of X0. Then the stabilizer of X is the morphisms that whose source and target are both X. Okay, and as they keep you at that point. Okay, as long that they form a group, right? And that group should be a finite group for every X. Okay, that's a Deline-Mumford stack, and a slightly hairier thing called an Artin stack is where you relax that finiteness condition, and you allow infinite stabilizer groups or even positive dimensional stabilizer groups. Okay, let me give some examples since this was very abstract. Let's look at some examples. So here's our main example, which is Y mod gamma. Okay, so take X not to be Y. X1 is Y cross gamma, where P0 of the pair gives you Y, and P1 gives you gamma acting on Y. Source and target. Okay? The isomorphism classes of objects in Y mod gamma are just the points of the quotient, but the stack remembers the stabilizer groups of each point, because that's what you want to keep track of, the stabilizer groups. Okay, another example too. Any manifold, any smooth manifold is a stack, with the groupoid just having the identity morphism for each point. Okay, so X0 equals X1 equals X. That's a stack. Here's something interesting. Here's where things get interesting. Let's consider an open cover of X. Okay. And let's take the disjoint union of all of the open patches to be X0. And then for X1, we'll take all the disjoint union of all of the patch overlaps. Okay? And so for every point in our original manifold, we'll put an extra pair of morphisms which identifies the two points and the two patches that it lives on. Every point in the overlap between two patches will have an extra pair of arrows which identify the two points in UI and UJ. Okay? In other words, the maps P0 and P1 from UIJ are just the inclusions into UI and UJ respectively. Okay, so remember before every point just had the identity morphism, now add an extra pair which says that if the point occurs in the overlap between two patches, we'll identify those. Okay? The whole difficulty of the subject of stacks is, of course, that, as you know, a manifold doesn't care what open cover you choose. You know, when you learn differential geometry, you know, they taught you all of this in terms of open covers. But, of course, you really knew that it didn't matter which open cover you chose to do your computation. They're all the same in some sense. Okay? The hard part of the theory of stacks, the reason why many mathematicians are afraid of it, is saying exactly what it means to say that two groupoids in this fashion are actually the same stack. Okay? Same thing as saying, when are two open covers really two different descriptions of the same manifold? Okay? So if you can keep that sort of slightly thorny problem in mind, that's the entire difficulty in the subject of stacks, saying when two open covers are the same. Okay? And now for us, the key property is that a map from any manifold into this quotient stack is just an equivariant map from a gamma principal bundle over M into Y, to the original space. Okay? Oh, boy. Yes. So now, now you can do everything that you learned for open covers. You learned how to do cohomology. You learned how to, vector bundles, everything was defined in terms of open covers. Okay, so let me, for instance, try to define, say, how you define a vector bundle on a stack, for instance. So what we do is we define a sort of simplicial space where the points of Xn are n simplices generated by composable morphisms. So you have triangles corresponding to a pair of morphisms that compose F and G. Okay. And you have tetrahedra corresponding to F, G, and H, which compose, and so on. Okay. And then, what's a vector bundle on X? Well, so again, these would be triple overlap. In the case of an open cover, these would be triple overlaps, quadruple overlaps, and so on. Okay. So, what's a vector bundle on X? Well, it's a vector bundle on X naught. An isomorphism of the pullback, the two pullbacks to X1, and then a compatibility condition on each triangle, X2, which says that if I consider the pullbacks via the source and target of this G and the source and target of this F, and I compose them, that's the same as considering the isomorphism from the source and target of F composed with G. Okay, that's what's called the cocycle condition for vector bundles. Same thing here. Okay? And cohomology, you can define cohomology. So for instance, the cohomology of a quotient stack is just the equivariant cohomology of Y. So particular examples, if you look at cohomology with Z2 coefficients and you look at an element of H1, this gives you double covers of Y with a lift of the gamma action to the double cover. If you look at the first Stieffer-Whitney class that measures whether Y is orientable and preserves an orientation, the second Stieffer-Whitney class tells you whether it admits a spin structure and so on. The K-theory of a quotient stack is just the equivariant K-theory of Y. And for orientifolds, we needed this more exotic theory, which I wrote down before. And, now I'll tell you, I guess, about this more exotic theory. And actually, the space-time data corresponding to an orientifold. So the space-time data consists of a stack X and a double cover. And so our primary examples will be where X is Y mod gamma, and the double cover is Y mod gamma naught. A B field has a couple of pieces. One, well, this is a little bit funny way to call it B field. The bit of the B field that you're used to is the one whose curvature is a three form, right? And that's the piece that lives here. But I'm also going to put it together with a piece from H1 with Z mod 2 coefficients. So I call these little h and little a. So little h is the I should explain what this twisted coefficients is. This is just that the H field is odd under the Z2 involution, right? There's a reverse orientation on the world sheet, the B field is odd, right? Or that the H field is odd. This is sort of a version of minus 1 to the F left. It tells you whether any particular element in gamma is accompanied by a minus 1 to the F left in the world sheet theory. Okay, and I'll explain that in a minute. And then the final ingredient is what's called a twisted spin structure. So t is either 0 or 1, depending on whether you're in type 2a or type 2b. And the Stieffer-Whitney classes of this stack x are determined to be either t times w. So w is this class we had up there. Find this double cover. So that condition is very familiar to you. What this says is that the orientifold action, the z2 is orientation preserving in the type 2b case, because t is 0, and it's orientation reversing in the type 2a case, because t is 1. Okay, that's that condition. The second condition says that the second Stieffer-Whitney class of this stack is t times w squared plus this a, the same a that appeared in the b field, times w. And that's a little bit more exotic, I have to say. Maybe it's worth pausing and asking, how the heck does the spin structure of the spacetime enter into the consistency of the world sheet theory? This is actually a very familiar question. If you go all the way back to supersymmetric quantum mechanics, consider a supersymmetric quantum mechanics model whose target space which is a sigma model whose target space is some Riemannian manifold M. Okay, the fermionic path integral, if you take trace minus 1 to the F, is supposed to be the determinant of the Dirac operator on M. And the first time you read this, you say, what the heck? Who said M even had a spin structure? I just said it was a Riemannian manifold. That's all that went into defining the sigma model. How the heck do I know it's got a spin structure? And if it has a spin structure, it could have more than one, and the determinant of the Dirac operator clearly depends on which one I choose. So how on earth could that be? Okay. And the answer is that it's a global anomaly. If the target space doesn't admit a spin structure, then the fermionic path integral is not actually a function on the space of bosonic fields. It's actually anomalous. And even if the anomaly cancels, actually trivializing and making it a function on the bosonic, the space of bosonic fields, requires a choice of spin structure, and the answer depends on the choice of spin structure. That's supersymmetric quantum mechanics. Same thing is true in string theory, and in the slightly more exotic orientifold situation, the same thing is true here. Okay, and now what I want to convince you of in just a few minutes is that you've been talking in prose all this time, that I've just described for you all of the type 2a and type 1 theories that you've ever discussed. They all fit into this language with just different choices of these of this data. So if I choose my stack to just be a manifold X, and X sub W is the trivial double cover, just two copies, okay? Then for T equals 0, you get type 2b theory, and for T equals 1, you get type 2a. Okay, that's those theories in this language. And the choice of A is actually very interesting. A is completely unconstrained, if we go back to here. So if I take W equals 0, because I'm doing the trivial double cover, then A is completely up for grabs, right? W1 and W2 both vanish, and A can be anything the heck you want. And what this is a set of theories where the spin structure for that come from the left movers and the right movers on the world sheet are independent. It's a perfectly possible theory. And there are a family of such consistent theories. They almost all break supersymmetry, but that's not the point. The point is that there are so consistent string backgrounds, albeit non-supersymmetric. And it's just that these two spin structures are related by tensoring with a flat real line bundle whose first Stieffer-Whitney class is A. Okay? So there's type 2A and type 2B in this family of slightly exotic type 2A and type 2B theories that you may or may not have run into. If you choose X to be the stack X times point mod Z2, which is to say it's X with the trivial Z2 action, okay, then you're constrained to, and you choose W equals alpha, where alpha is the universal element of H1 pulled back from point mod Z2. In other words, if you choose XW equals X, then the existence of a twisted spin structure, so let's go back again, the existence of a twisted spin structure, so W is alpha, So that means T must be zero because this bit doesn't know about the point mod Z2 thing. So T must be zero and A must be zero, which means that you're in type one theory. So that's how type one theory fits into this. If you choose X to be, say, R10 minus N cross Rn with reflections on the N coordinates, then W1 of X, and you choose W equals alpha, then satisfying the twisted spin structure condition basically forces T to be N mod 2 and A to be either 0 or alpha depending on the value of N mod 4, which again, if you look up in Polchinski, is the right set of N. Okay. So everything you've ever learned about orientifolds so far is summarized in just this, those conditions on the previous slide. Yes, it's all in here. Yes, and you have those examples too. Yes, indeed. As far as I know, all of the consistency conditions you need are on this slide over here. Okay, and every example that of which I am aware fits into this paradigm. I could only fit so much on one slide, but yes. And now the funny thing, so I wrote this B as this pair of this sort of twisted three form and this element of H1 with Z2 coefficients. But the funny thing is that actually the addition law in this group where these things take values is sort of twisted. These don't just add, there's an extra piece here acting on the H's, which depends on A. That is actually important for what we do. And then there's a right, and essentially the quadratic refinement that we're going to be looking at involves the index theorem or integration in KO theory. And so you need to somehow get from these sort of twisted KR groups said the D-brand charge lives in, into KO theory where you can do an integral and essentially get the define this quadratic form as a func taking a class X and essentially mapping it to XX bar, which lives in the relevant KO group and can be integrated. I'm getting tired, so I'm just going to specialize to X's. Just some Z2 action on some target space and not try to do the general case. Just an ordinary manifold with an involution whose generator is sigma. And let's let F be the fixed point set of sigma, which could be all of X if sigma acts trivially, or it could be empty if sigma acts freely, or it could be something in between. And a priori, if sigma is orientation preserving, that means that the codimension of F is even, and if it's orientation reversing, that means that the codimension of F is odd. But the fact that you actually need a twisted spin structure actually forces the codimension of F to be well-defined mod 4, not mod 2. It's a little bit stronger. And we'll just accompany sigma by a reversal of orientation on the world sheet. And and I'll just consider, and for the most part, I'll be interested in the so-called universal twistings, which come from pulling back from a point. And depending on the codimension of F mod 4, the consistency with having a twisted spin structure is only two of the four of these four are consistent and lead to OP plus and OP minus planes. So those are the familiar object. So as I said, this is basically given by some sort of index theory type computation. I'm not sure how valuable it. I'm not going to explain this well, so maybe I shouldn't try. And then what we need to do is take this quadratic form and subtract, take Q minus, it's a horrible clash of notation here. What we called minus x in K-theory means the parity, in this model of K-theory of Z2 graded vector bundles, it's the parity reversal of the class x. So what was an even vector bundle becomes odd, and what was odd becomes even. And I should take Q of x minus Q of its parity reversal and pull out a certain piece of that. And that's this linear function psi, which when I sort of divide by 2 is the center of the quadratic form. And now, going very fast, but we have to be out of here precisely at 2 o'clock, I understand, and I want to have time for a few questions. After inverting 2, the formula for this actually localizes the fixed point set. So in KO with 2 inverted, it's given by an integral over the fixed point set of, the denominator over here is the spinner bundle of the normal bundle to the fixed point set. And in the numerator, we have what's called the Adams operation. For a vector bundle, it's just sim2 of the symmetric square minus the anti-symmetric square. Or maybe even more basically, if I act on a line bundle, I just get the square of the line bundle. And it's linear, you know, if I take direct sums and so on, it acts in some linear fashion. So the point is that after inverting 2, it has an inverse. And here, if you've gotten bored or lost or whatever, you can amuse yourself by checking the following fact. Namely, so if I write a line bundle as the trivial rank 1 bundle plus x, with x being nilpotent, then since psi 2 of L is L squared, psi 1 half of L is the square root of 1 plus x, which when I expand out using the Taylor expansion, only powers of 2 appear in the denominator. Okay, and so this expression makes sense once you invert 2. Okay, so if you're bored now you can do a little computation to check that the Taylor expansion of the square root of 1 plus x only has powers of 2 in the denominator.
When you divide by bundle, you mean a chunk?
No, I literally mean divide by the bundle, because again, write the bundle as its rank plus something nilpotent, and then use this Taylor expansion formula. No, I mean the bundle. I mean, write any bundle V as being rank of V times the trivial bundle plus X. Remember, in K-theory, I'm allowed to add and subtract, right? Okay, so X is the formal difference between the trivial bundle and the original thing V, okay? But the point is X is nilpotent in K-theory. Okay, because it has rank 0. Okay, so some power of x is 0. So now I can divide by, so 1 over v is just given by the Taylor expansion with x as a formal parameter. Okay, so it makes sense to divide. What's tricky though is, you see, the rank of, I get 1 over the rank. This starts as 1 over the rank. Okay, so that in general doesn't make sense over the integers, but since the spin bundle is even, is its dimension is a power of 2, it makes sense when you invert 2. So this is integration in KO theory, which means take the index. Okay, so it's given by some index formula. Okay, as a formula in K theory. Okay, so right. I'll actually give you a nice, even more concrete formula in a minute. So hold on a sec. So this has an inverse, you see. So I can now pull out the psi 2 over here by inverting its action on that. And now, it's something which I love the name of, and so I really do wish to write a paper with this name in there. It's called the Bot Cannibalistic Class, which is the analog of the Wu class in Z2 valued cohomology. The fact is that the integral in K theory or KO theory with 1/2 inverted of psi 2 of anything is given by the product of that thing with this Wu class rho. And rho turns out to be just psi 1/2 of the spin bundle. And so the upshot is that I can write the formula for mu. Remember, this is the center. This is the background charge, background d-brain charge due to the orientifold, as being just minus psi 1/2 of the ratio of the spin bundle of the fixed point set divided by the spin bundle of the normal bundle. Okay, and that this now I should put a box around it. That is the formula for this. I specialized a little bit. I said I was just going to consider Z2 actions, blah, blah, blah. But in this particular case, the formula is that simple and nice. And what's nice about it is that in the derivation, I assumed that F was spin because, remember, I said I was going to take some index, right? Well, index of a Dirac operator only makes sense if the thing is spin, right? But in fact, this ratio actually makes sense even though the total space, you know, the 10 manifold is spin, right? But the fixed point set need not be. But if the fixed point set isn't, then neither is the normal bundle. But the ratio of the two things makes sense, right? You can, you know, this is the same story you see with spin C structures and so on. So the ratio can make sense even when separately these don't make sense. Because say F is only spin C, the ratio does make sense, and so this formula even works in those cases. And if you take Chern characters, which is the way you get down to formulas you see in the textbooks, so you just use the usual formula for the coupling of the Ramond field to some charge, right? Integrated over the manifold. And you get a formula that's hopefully quite familiar, which is this formula localized on the d-brain world volume, right? It's got the Chern class of the bundle on the d-brain world volume and the square root of the ratio of the A-roof genuses for the world volume and the normal bundle times the pullback of the Ramond field to that thing. Hopefully that's a familiar looking formula to everybody. It's the same formula here, but with mu being the orientifold charge defined above. And if you do a nice little computation using, you know, these characteristic polynomials and the splitting principle, you find this formula, I think, first written down by Spruka and Cerrone for the thing charge rationally. So this is what you find. But the key thing is that the formula itself has much more information in it because it has I've inverted two, so I've lost all of the two torsion and everything, but there's still three torsion and so on. And so there's lots more information in that formula than there was in the formula of Spruka and Cerrone. And so there are examples, and I've done computations of explicit examples to compute this charge in those cases. And you can find configurations of d-brains where you can cancel this rationally, in other words, after taking Chern classes, but still have some Z3 valued thing left over uncancelled. I should say that this is, I'm almost certain, not going to happen anytime you have a supersymmetric configuration. Okay, but people love to consider configurations of d-brains and anti-d-brains or whatever, where you break supersymmetry, right? And in a situation where supersymmetry is broken, it's very easy to imagine cases where supersymmetry is broken, you've canceled the charge rationally, but you've left over this, Z3 or whatever valued charge uncancelled, and the background's actually inconsistent. Okay. So that's kind of what I was sort of after. But anyways, just to summarize the procedure here, you prescribe the what B field you're choosing. I've now given you a formula or a procedure for computing the orientifold charge. And then you choose where you put your D brains. That's this thing I call J. And then if the sum of these two is trivial, then in the relevant twisted KR group, then you can solve for the Ramond-Ramond field. And the notion of having different choices of Ramond-Ramond flux corresponds to having multiple solutions. Okay, those are your different choices of Ramond-Ramond field, which each of which separately cancels the sum of the orientifold and the D-brain contributions to the chart. Okay, if this class is non-trivial over the integers, I remind you, then there's no solution for the Ramond-Ramond field, and the background is just inconsistent. Okay, so this was what I was talking about before, finding inconsistent backgrounds. And so I'd like to... Yeah. Well, it's like Gauss's law. You don't satisfy Gauss's law. You wouldn't see it. I mean, it's a very subtle quantum effect. Yeah, it's not something you see in supergravity, but it's really there. Yeah, and I really like to understand his story, because I don't understand his story. I like to match it on to what to this result. He sort of had some way involving deep brain probes, right, and saying that. But the thing that's confusing to me is there are certainly deep brain probes where there's a world volume anomaly, and so, for instance, the paradigmatic example is the Fried-Witten anomaly. And you just say, well, you're not allowed to wrap a D-brain around that cycle. Because if you did, the world volume theory would be anomalous. That's what Fried and Witten say. So I'm a little confused about how that fits into Oranga's picture, where he's using the world volume anomaly on a D-brain probe as a diagnostic for this uncancelled charge. I mean, how do you distinguish that from the case where you're just not allowed to stick a D-brain probe wrapping that cycle? I'm confused about that. But, you know, if you have any insight, that would be interesting. Anyways, my a PhD advisor was Sidney Coleman, and he loved to engage in what he called destructive field theory. And so this is what I think we could call what how'd that happen? In principle, the considerations I've outlined may rule out some previously proposed string backgrounds. If not, I'd be surprised if it didn't eliminate any, but I'm not about to go through the vast literature of backgrounds looking for ones that are eliminated by this. It's kind of a thankless task. The authors of those papers won't thank you, and nobody else will. So it at least should be considered as a check on newly proposed backgrounds. It's a consistency condition which, you know, going forward, people should check that they satisfy, even if nobody's going to go back through all of the previous literature looking for cases where it wasn't satisfied. And there are all sorts of variations on this which hopefully are streamlined by our new fancy formalism that I outlined in these talks. But, you know, we keep, as I say, rewriting the first part of the paper to make it more, you know, streamlined and beautiful and so on. If we had it, well, I don't know. Yeah. Okay, well, that's good. And in any case, I think that, you know, the techniques that I've discussed here are actually pretty interesting and powerful, and they really do organize the subject of orientifolds in a very nice way, and hopefully you'll be able to at least come away from this talk having found something useful in whatever it is you're working on. So I will end there right on time.
Any questions? So at the only discussion has really been just focused our understanding of the large volume.
In the sense that K-theory is valid?
Geometry and K-theory.
Yeah. Well, indeed, that's a very tricky question. You know, I mean, in principle, many of the words on a very early slide that I discussed. Where's a couple of seconds? Oh, there we go. Where's the early? Let's see this slide. Yeah, I think this slide. I mean, one can phrase the words here just as in the previous slide where I discussed orbifolds. One can phrase that in a CFT language. I think you can phrase this discussion in a CFT language. What would be nice is if I could phrase the computation of the center of this quadratic refinement in some CFT language, because that would be the tadpole condition in some CFT language. I don't really know how to do that, but at least this much of the setup, I certainly do know how to do in a CFT language. This is fairly easy to state in a general, but it's only part of the story. So you're right.
That's
the what's stable can jump. That's right. Yeah. So like I said, one of the things that so you know the main message of my talk was I'm really trying to understand something topological. Okay. Which so I'm not worried about whether these things are stable or satisfy any equations of motion or anything like that. I'm really trying to satisfy Gauss's law, which is a purely topological condition. And even when these funny effects that you talk about happen, it doesn't change whether or not Gauss's law is satisfied.
But can you go one layer higher and say, can you follow this?
It would be interesting to know if this had any ramifications for some of the decay processes. So, you know, I spent a certain amount of time, you know, thinking about sort of torsion debrands and such like things. And it would be interesting to apply some of these considerations to that story, because certainly in orientifold backgrounds, we've now clarified where exactly these things live, well, what kind of K theory or differential K group they sort of live in. And this is something that was always somewhat obscure before, though people had very definite answers. It wasn't clear that they were definitely right. But I'm pretty sure this is the right formulation of things. So yeah, I mean, I think there are some applications there. I'll be around for the rest of the week, so if questions occur, you know, I will be there to answer them.